ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Today on Future Tense on ABC Radio National, how much content on the internet is actually being written by artificial intelligence? What's happened to Google search? Why city design shouldn't be automated? And I'll be joined later by my co-producer Karin Savanovitz for a special announcement, so make sure you stay with us for that. Welcome to the program. I'm Anthony Fennell. How much of what we read on the internet is now being generated by artificial intelligence? Is it mostly drafted by bots, or are humans still the dominant creators? It's hard to tell. And if you have a skeptical brain like mine, you probably fear the worst. Megan Maroney is the tech editor for Axios, and she's been looking at research into the growth of AI-generated articles, including a recent study conducted by researchers at the search engine optimization company Graphite. Megan Maroney.
So what they found was that beginning around the launch of ChatGPT, which is about 3 years ago, the rise in AI-generated content online was a very steep curve upwards. And it kept going up until around November 2024. And at that point, it sort of matched the human-generated content, which I think was the thing that I found most fascinating. I mean, it's obvious that there was very little AI-generated content before ChatGPT launched, but the fact that it sort of leveled out shows a lot of people are tired of reading AI-generated content. It doesn't do well in search, and the search engines have gotten better at sort of deprioritizing the stuff that's just AI slop.
And that's fascinating in itself, isn't it? It's ironic in the sense that AI chatbots and search are deprioritizing, if that's correct, AI content.
So I talked to Google about this, and they said, you know, they don't really care if something is AI generated or human generated as long as it's good. Like, spam is spam. And so if something has, you know, a bunch of just gibberish in it and nobody enjoys reading it, the algorithm is going to deprioritize it just like it always has, whether it was written by a bot or, you know, someone just typing in their apartment with very little knowledge of the subject that they're writing about.
Do you expect that this situation will change over time? You know, if technologists are correct and AI just becomes better at doing its thing, is it possible that the amount of AI-generated content online will start to creep up?
I do think that that is probably the case. I mean, that they also looked at those AI-generated summaries, you know, that we all see now, and they're everywhere, whether we want them or not. And I do think the AI is getting better and better at writing. And, you know, 3 years ago, I thought, okay, well, we're going to have to come up with a standard where everyone sort of, they disclose whether they've used AI or not in their writing. And that has just proven to be almost non-existent. Like, there are very few, there are like some universities and colleges and high schools that are trying to, you know, bring back the footnotes and say, you know, tell exactly how you used AI. But so far, those efforts don't seem to be widely taking, which is a huge problem, because I think that what we've seen, and I've, you know, done research, the amount of people using AI in secret is very high percentage. And it's worrying because, you know, I think it just leads to the whole anxiety that people have. Oh, well, I have to use AI or I'm going to lose my job, but I don't want anyone to know I'm using AI because then I'll look lazy. So it's just a very confusing time. So I do think we will see an increase of people using AI for writing. It will get better, but it will continue to do two things: make a lot of mistakes. And I think the other thing it's going to lead to is less diversity of ideas, less creativity. We're going to start seeing like the same words. So that's the hard part. I think there's going to be fewer original ideas.
Well, Megan Maroney, thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
Thank you for having me.
The boss of Google's parent company, Alphabet, a man named Sundar Pichai, recently told the BBC in an exclusive interview that people shouldn't, and here's the quote, blindly trust everything that AI chatbots tell them. But here's a curious thing. That message of caution comes as Google is going all out to transform its very successful search engine. It's now prioritizing those AI summaries that Megan talked about over its traditional search format. Why, you ask? Here's Dr. Colin Jennings to explain. But let's start first with what made Google's original algorithmic system, known as PageRank, what made that so successful?
Well, it revolutionized, I think, the way researchers thought about what mattered in terms of navigating the internet. Prior to Google's PageRank, most internet search engines simply relied on linguistic relationships. So term, frequencies, various algorithms from information retrieval that ranked words based on their frequencies on pages relative to their rarity on other pages. And what PageRank introduced was a kind of social dimension, right? The connections among other pages that provide prestige to a certain page and indicate its credibility, its trustworthiness. And while that method was not novel to other fields within the internet, it was, and it gave Google a leg up on every other search engine that it then leveraged to turn itself into the global dominator in search. I think it was the kind of, in some ways, the magic ingredient for Google in terms of its progress in the early 21st century.
And in terms of connections, the value of it then was understanding social connections, as you said, but also physical connections.
Yes, physical and connections in the sense of connections that are reflected in terms of relationships outside of the internet, right? So often links reflect social connections that are found in the world. And that was something that Larry Page and Sergey Brin of Google sort of recognized, that social relationships, physical relationships, proximity, various types of association that occur and exist outside of the internet are meaningful for understanding how information flows on the internet.
Now, Google and other websites are moving away from a reliance on links. They're moving away from the established search result interface. What's their goal?
So their goal is to provide information more, I think, easily in a more synthesized way. What they're moving towards are automated summaries, list bullet points, right? We think of the interface for ChatGPT as the first really popularizer of this mode of representing information. If you ask ChatGPT a question, it will provide a concise and relatively kind of neutral answer, often with bullet points that go into more detail, and then a kind of conclusive summary sentence. And similarly, now Google has moved towards automated summaries for many of their factual types of search queries, especially if you do any type of work in computer science and programming. If you ask for help for a programming problem, it will largely often just provide you the code rather than directing you to the actual web page. So it is, in some sense, meant to be the ultimate landing spot for searchers. No longer do you need to actually peruse through results yourself. They will give you the distilled summary right for you, so you don't have to go past the Google or the ChatGPT homepage.
Now, you see issues with that, don't you? You talk about the emergence of a linkless internet. What are the issues that you see?
The first immediate problem is that if you're only relying on the summarized output of Google or ChatGPT, you are not giving yourself as a kind of searcher an opportunity to actually think about or examine where those sources are coming from. Often the results pulled from Google or ChatGPT are coming from online message boards, Reddit threads, Quora threads, right? And so the credibility of the results that are being synthesized, you're not evaluating them directly. But I think more importantly, the fact is that the large language models that lay behind Google's Gemini or the ChatGPT model are trained on the material of the internet. They crawl the websites, they ingest all of the information and language of websites that make up the internet. So the links, the web pages themselves are the raw data that these models rely upon in order to produce the results. And if users of the internet are no longer making it past the homepages of search engines or various AI websites, then that raw data starts to no longer be developed or supported by the traffic it relies upon to actually be sustainable. In some ways, the actual foundation of the knowledge that Google and ChatGPT are trying to pull from is being kind of eroded, right? And at some point, if most web traffic is just limited to the homepages of search engines, then there's a question of where new information, new knowledge is actually being presented, being produced, and being evaluated.
So there's a narrowing of information with this system. What about verification? I mean, does it also make verification of the authenticity of information much more difficult?
Certainly, because often for something like ChatGPT or Gemini, the sources of the information are not being identified. There are some AI engines that cite sources, but even that seems like in the case of Perplexity is a very popular one that will provide the same summarized result, but it will include footnotes to certain websites. What's actually happening in an engine like that is that it's using a kind of search that indexes the web mapped onto its large language model. So while it's able to kind of pair particular web page results with its synthesized summary, often websites like that, like Perplexity, have been found to have factual errors, to plagiarize, to not credit where they're actually pulling their language from, but rather just kind of mapping the search on top of the summarized results. So there are certainly all kinds of issues of plagiarism, of verification, factuality that happen in terms of moving from specific sources to this synthesized authorless response that we receive from AI chatbots.
Academic and author Colin Jennings. And you're with Future Tense on ABC Radio National. I'm Anthony Fennell. David Holm is our next guest, and David is a principal at the firm Cox Architecture. He also happens to be an author, an artist, and an academic. Architecture, as we've heard on this program several times in the past, is one of those creative industries most impacted by AI. Because why get a human to design a building when you can get a machine to do it for you? David has a new book out called Drawing the City, and his career has spanned the eras of analog drafting and AI-assisted modelling and concept design. So where does he believe the pendulum now sits between those two?
It's an interesting question. My training obviously was in that sort of that formal sense, almost a Beaux-Arts education of drawing, observing and drawing and understanding the connection between the eye and the hand. I don't think that will ever go away. So we just adopt ourselves with different tools as time goes by. Certainly the studio that I work in, we work across many of those tools, including, you know, physical model making, 3D model making as well. So the creative act really is that sort of connection from, you know, mind to hand to made objects, I think. So whether that's in my case a drawing or whether it's electronica, it's all to be embraced.
Because there was a fear at one stage that AI would take over from the architect, that there was no need for an architect anymore.
I think that fear perhaps still exists. One of the issues with AI, of course, is that it looks behind, it gathers what has gone before, whereas the creative act, as always, is about that sort of that magical collision between ideas and reality going forward. And I think that's the key that will sit with humanity, not just with architects.
You make the case for what you call human-scale thinking when looking at the development of future cities. What do you mean by that exactly?
It's probably based around the community in many respects. And interesting in that point was that the modernist movement that sort of took ground in the early 20th century was very focused on functional segregation. And what we think now is very much about the idea of a more complex, in a good way, of living, so that you basically endure, I guess, a great community sense whenever you're in a mixed-use community, all sorts of different people. There was a great American urbanist from the last part of the 20th century, and Jane Jacobs, her advocacy was about having eyes on the street. So it was about people who were over a 24-hour period were doing different activities, but you got to know a familiarity with the grocer, with the person that mended your shoes, you know, with the school children. There were diverse activities that happened. So that really is at the core of community, and I think that's what people want. What we're seeing is a massive increase in the rate of urbanisation around the world. So what that does, it puts cities at risk. And so one of my key areas of study is in the provision of public place. How do we gather? How do we make communities? And that's, you know, if you like, ranging from the romantic Italian piazzas to just the good structure of a street to be experienced. So a lot of the work that we do tries to understand how those public places work and indeed how they're going to be provisioned as cities become denser going into the future.
You argue, don't you, that the spaces between buildings matter more than the buildings themselves in many ways?
I have the lucky privilege of having 2 degrees, the first as an architect and the second as an urban designer. And when I finished architecture, I thought I knew a lot. And then when I went back and did the urban design, I fell in love really with the idea of the space between buildings and the importance of those spaces and places. I'm sitting here in the ABC now and looking over the volumetric space in Sydney. And again, it's the gathering place. It's where people meet. And it's so often used, and it's so often the way that we actually gather, places of transport, places of markets, etc., that they become part of our DNA, the way we actually meet people, the way we carry out our daily business.
Are we, though, seeing that kind of holistic approach, that kind of perspective, broader perspective, being put to urban planning? Are you seeing that at the moment?
Look, I think we are. There is a heightened and really healthy interest in the provision of place, and that has a sustainability thread to it. So there are places that, you know, have attention towards, you know, water and shading, etc. So we've all been in urban places that potentially aren't friendly. What we're seeing now is a much more developed dialogue about spaces that are safe, spaces that are available for all sorts of people, all ages, genders, etc. And that's a really important piece moving forward, is that the core of our civic community is very much grounded in public place that is guaranteed for us all to use in various modes of our daily lives.
In many countries around the world at the moment, we're seeing what's being termed a housing crisis, and there's a call for more housing to be built. That's obviously a good thing, but is there a danger in that we rush and we don't get the design right? We end up causing future problems for our cities.
I think what will happen is that the traditional ways that we build will evolve. We certainly see that there's a much higher interest now in what's called modularity. So it's moving away from the traditional way that housing especially was built, you know, with single bricks, etc. That idea of building in pods and modularity is a really good thing, because it can make things happen in a much more accelerated situation. Coupled with that, though, is probably a move towards smaller dwelling units, so more like apartment living. And that again goes back to the idea of the provision of public place. So traditionally, certainly in the Australian idiom, we may well have had a backyard growing up. Now, how do we achieve that? How are those public places engaged into our community? How do we get to go and have our swimming lessons and play cricket and those kind of issues? So whilst we need to provide the housing in potentially a faster method, we also need to make sure that that public place is almost in equal, if not greater, proportion.
Are there lessons to be drawn from, I'm thinking, cities like Singapore and Hong Kong, which have dealt with density issues for a very long time?
A lot of my studies really dove into the densest cities in the world. And over my travels, I've been to places like Mumbai and Dhaka in Bangladesh, are the couple of the most dense cities in the world. And it's really interesting, because a lot of the people who live there, they see that a city should be dense, can be dense and be a positive place. And it's a place where people come to fulfill their hopes and dreams and joys and loves, etc. So density is often seen in the negative. And as you mentioned, Singapore, Hong Kong and other certainly Asian cities and environments can do density well. It's that how you get that combination into the community as well that sits as an important feature.
Tell us about your book, Drawing the City, in which you document the changes in more than 500 urban spaces over four decades. What's the central message from that?
Central message, I think, is that in my learnings in sort of over, say, 500 observations around the world over that 40 years, is the way that people use public place is quite consistent. I've categorised the public places into four categories: those of the traditional public place that we all sort of know and love, the central parks of New York, etc. Secondly, infrastructure, and that's an emerging one with the invention of the railway and latterly the invention of the aircraft. We've travelled a lot more now. We're much more mobile. So places like railway stations and airports are becoming public places as well, and they should be. They should be extensions of the urban environment. The third is mercantile places. So, you know, we think about some great marketplaces around the world. The Grand Markets in Istanbul is a wonderful situation where you may not necessarily go there to actually buy anything, but it's just a wonderful experience. And then the fourth of those is ceremonial. And, you know, a great example of that is the 9/11 memorial in New York City. So places are actually put in a situation in communities that people can go there. There's a purpose, in the case of sort of very somber purpose, but people still go there, and it's part of the recreation component of the city. So in drawing those, for my thinking, is that all cultures, all people really have this common theme about how they use good quality public place. Behaviours are often better in quality public places, and I just think we can see the best in humanities. And that doesn't necessarily mean that things like protests or various uses can happen in public places. They should be diverse to allow all manner of activities over time.
Professor David Holm, architect, artist and academic. And now I'm joined by my Future Tense co-producer, Karin Savanovits.
Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Karin. We have some news. Next week is the final Future Tense episode for 2025, and indeed the final installment ever.
That's right. After 17 years, the show is ending on a high. And next week we'll mark the final episode with a special retrospective, looking back at the issues we have covered over those years and what we have learned about our very human fascination with the future.
Now, Karen, you've been with Future Tense for what? Well over a decade? Not just as a co-producer, but also as the show's co-creator. So I think it's appropriate that I say thank you very much for all your creativity and effort over those years.
Thank you. And it was an absolute pleasure to work with you on the show.
And we should just remind the audience that you haven't just operated behind the scenes. In fact, over the years, you've presented several episodes. So I thought to take us out today, let's revisit one of your programs. Which one have you chosen?
The one about digital technology opening up new relationships between humans and animals. And not just because that episode features my cat Sari, but also because it shows what we on Future Tense call the Future Tense angle. Technology and trends at the edge, you know, not quite there, but hinting at the change to come.
Take it away, Karen.
That's my black cat, Sari, and she's clearly asking for a treat here. And that means, open this door for me now. Most of us know quite well what our animals want to tell us. But in some situations, quite well is just not good enough. For example, with guide dogs. Associate Professor of Computer Science David Roberts has developed a harness to improve the communication between a disabled person and his assistant.
The harness is a wearable system. So we have computing devices and sensors that we've put on the dog. The sensors are monitoring things about what the dog is doing, in particular their movement and body position, as well as their physiology. So their heart rate and respiratory rate. And using wireless communications, we're able to send that information to a computer or laptop that's nearby, and machine learning algorithms, data mining algorithms go through that and interpret things about what the dog is doing. I'll use panting as an example. Panting is a thermoregulatory process, but it's also a stress process. And the subtle differences between those two requires really an expert eye to detect the differences reliably. But the physiological signals that correlate with those things, the changes in heart rate, the changes in respiratory rate, are things that can be measured much more objectively using technology.
With this really detailed interpretation, how far off are we?
I would say we're still pretty far off. The technology that we have is very much a research technology. We've shown a lot of promise, but there's still a lot more that we need to do in terms of expanding beyond the core behaviors that we've started with, right? So we've put a lot of effort into stress and anxiety, but there are many other things I think that people would be very interested to know about their dogs that we haven't really started on. And then there's also the natural sort of progression of the technology from the research lab to becoming a commercial product. So I would estimate that we're probably at least 7 to 10 years away from something really viable being available.
Now, at another American university, Georgia Tech, researchers have also been creating a smart harness. It's what they call the FIDO project. But their device works in a different way to the one David Roberts and his team are developing.
We are passively monitoring dogs for their natural communications. The group at Georgia Tech is instrumenting dogs with active sensors, so things that the dogs can be trained to intentionally operate to send signals back to humans through computers. These are things like tug sensors or bite sensors or proximity sensors that the dogs can be trained to operate intentionally to indicate things to their handlers or to their humans. I will give you an anecdote, which I think is just a fantastic example of the potential of this technology. So the anecdote is about a woman in a wheelchair, and she got into a position where her wheelchair was stuck and she needed help. And so she was able to send her dog up to another group of people, and the dog tugged on its harness, which played a recorded sound through a speaker, which said, "Help, my owner needs your help, please follow me."
So your team at North Carolina State University have also been using the harness to develop a better initial training program for working dogs. What are the advantages it offers?
The fundamental characteristics of training that make it effective are measured by three different characteristics. So number one is timing. And that is when dogs are, or all animals, this is actually universal, it's not just dogs, when they perform a behavior and there's a consequence for that behavior, and the consequence in our case is always reinforcement, a food reward or play, the time delay between when they perform that behavior and when the consequence or the reinforcement occurs is very predictive of how quickly the animal learns. And computers, as you know, are very fast. The second characteristic that's really important is criteria. So making sure that the behaviors that get reinforced are very consistent. And computers have infinite patience and can be made to pay great attention. And so they can be extremely consistent in what they reinforce. The last then is the rate of reinforcement, or how much behaviors get reinforced in any period of time. And we know that the more reinforcement that can occur in any period of time, the faster learning occurs. And computers have perfect accuracy in measuring this in real time. So those three key elements are critical to the success of training, and there are three things that computers have distinct advantages over people at.
Now, the logical question flowing from this is, does the technology open a new door for communication between humans and dogs?
It's my sincere belief that it does. I believe that technology opens up a window for untold possibilities. I think the future possibilities are virtually limitless once we have really cracked the code, once we've really matured this technology to the point that we can detect a wide array of animal behaviors, and not just with dogs. I liken what we're doing here to the design of a keyboard and mouse and screen for a computer. And so what we're trying to do is build the equivalent of these devices for dogs so that they can operate and interact with computers in a way that enables them to communicate more effectively with humans. So the harness is the mediator. It's the interface that enables us to send information to the dog and get information from the dog. It's the algorithms that we implement on computers that go through and interpret that data that perform the role of translation. We will be able to get meaningful information to and from dogs using technology like this at some point in the future. Things that help us understand our dog's moods, whether they're happy or sad, tired, not feeling well. We may even be able to get to the point of localizing some information, why they're not feeling well. But let me qualify that by saying, I don't think we will ever get to the point where our dogs will be able to speak to us using our language through a communication device. Dogs don't have, from everything we can tell, they don't have the cognitive ability to form and produce language the way that humans do.
David Roberts from North Carolina State University. So, as much as we love our pets, we'll have to rely on our own powers of interpretation to understand what they're trying to tell us. Yes, my little darling, me too. I'm Karin Zivanovits, and you've been listening to Future Tense.
Very nicely put. And don't forget, next week, a Future Tense retrospective, looking back over the last 17 years. And I should just mention that I'm not disappearing from the airwaves completely. I'm moving over to co-present Radio National's Rear Vision program in 2026. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.